Great. We're going to start out with the Bach. If you've heard of the Bach? If you haven't heard of the Bach, the guy on the side of the
Gemara. How did he find time to write music and learn that much? I don't know.
Okay. This is the same joke to David. He's like, huh, you're being cute now, aren't you?
Okay. The Bach's name was is given as Rabbi Yoel Sirkis. Okay, well, for those who've attended this a lot of times, they're going to figure it out on their own.
Oh, he's Spartan.
No, he's not.
No, you literally have not attended a lot.
He's not.
Sirkis?
Rabbi?
I thought...
Noel?
Is that a case?
That's okay.
What's the focus of this?
What are we trying to figure out?
History, but this is this first we're analyzing names because it is historical. So what do you think? What do you think I should do to this name?
Take off the S.
Honestly, I have no idea what's going on.
Take off the cut.
Oh, right.
His mother-in-law's name was probably Circa.
Right. Same with what was it?
Similar.
Adels,
similar to the Marsha. He was called after his mother-in-law, whose name was Adel.
So
it's very logical to believe that the Bach did not really have a last name. And his circus is like circus son-in-law or something like that. 1561 to 1640.
Can you return, please?
He typically speaking, as mentioned earlier,
am I the recorder?
As mentioned earlier, Rabbanim in this period of time were given 3 to 5 year contracts, and the Bach served all over the place, Poland, Belarus, Ukraine, as a matter of fact, including Brisk and Medjibej. Now today, we think that Brisk and Medjibej are polar opposites. As a matter of fact, if you ask Rabbi David about it, I wonder if he actually knows this historical nugget, that the Bach was Rav, he'll know he was Rav in Brisk. That's like a well-known fact. But that he was also in Rabbanus and Medjibej, I'm not sure if he knows it, but that just goes to show you that the division which later occurred between Lithuania and Belarus and Ukraine, Galicia, Central Poland, is really, post-Hasidic division. And pre-Hasidus, the division didn't exist, and the Bach was able to serve all over the place. Yes?
Is it even possible so?
What?
Medjibej?
Medjibej, I believe, is spelled Medzibos or B-E-Z. Medzibez or B-O-Z. Medjibej.
I would have never guessed that.
Yeah. Now, well, Polish, I don't know if you have any of you guys made a poem yet? No. Okay, no. Polish is, you take a couple straws in your mouth and start talking. You do that, you sort of be talking in Polish. That's what it sounded like to me. Okay, get the straws out of your mouth already.
Where they
and it's like Arabic. Yeah. Arabic is like a guy's clearing his throat for a very long time.
Yeah, it's very guttural.
You'll pat the guy in the back. Come on, get that from up already. Yeah, okay. Actually, the truth is, after being in Israel a very long time, I can actually hear Arabs say words to each other clearly. I've told it to Israeli friends of mine.
They have words?
Yes, they do. I told it to Israeli friends of mine, and they were very impressed.
I thought
because they're Israeli and they can't hear words. They also hear him just clearing their throat.
I thought they had yet to create a language. I thought they were just like four.
Okay.
Four
well, what's the Bach of course.
It's more sophisticated than
those are people.
I don't know. I'm not sure about that, but whatever. Okay. There's two things that Bach is known for. Two major things that Bach is known for.
His work on Pedro's of the Flemish?
No, on Chumash.
Gemara, I meant Gemara.
One is on the Gemara. It's not Perish, it's editing. It's editing. The Bach is the great editor of Shas.
Oh,
better than the Rish?
Editor, not Posik, not Halachic decider, rather editor. He makes most of I would say a majority of the Bach's emendations are of what I call cosmetic and smoothness and grammatical improvements and things like that. Like there's little words here and there he'll take out and smooth up where the tuzzles. I did not research where, it's like a fascinating question where he got, there are times when he like really significantly changes the rasha. And that of course will lead us to the obvious question, where did he get that from? And to never saw anything substantial about it.
620. Yeah.
What?
620.
Thank you. I never saw anything substantial about it, so I can't tell you anything substantial about it. Now, that's one thing the Bach is well known for. Why is he called the Bach? What does Bach mean?
Rabbeinu Bachai.
Bayez Chadash. Very good, Yosef Dov. Bayez Chadash.
I'm like O for O here.
The Bayez Chadash is, what does that mean?
The new house.
The new house as opposed to?
Old.
Josh says old. Bayez Chadash.
Yashin.
What's that opposed to? Versus? Who's he opposing?
Christianity?
No. Maybe there's a shoe.
There we go.
Oh, I thought we were talking about faction, not person.
We're talking about... Yeah, no, we're talking about person. The Bach... The Bach has two issues with the Beis Yosef. Bach has two issues with the Beis Yosef. One issue with the Beis Yosef is the Beis Yosef, even though he does explain the tour, he really didn't write his commentary to it. The Beis Yosef is more of a compendium of the sugya, etc., etc. Than what?
The Beis Yosef is
a machaber. It's machaber. It's Yosef Kara. It's more of a compendium of the Rishonim rather than perish of the tour. So the Bach, wasn't so happy with that. Yeah, the Sma wasn't either. So the Bach also wanted to write a parish on the tour. Now he also, in that great school of thought of how much you go after the later poskim and how much you go after the sugya, the Bach tends to go more after the sugya than after the later poskim. That's like a great, we've spoken about that many times, and that to an extent even applies until more or less contemporary poskim. Exactly how you deal in psak halacha. I mean, for example, there are people who are of the opinion, I hold they're wrong, and I'm pretty sure Rabbi David would agree with me, that if you look at Igros Moshe, it a lot of times looks like he gives lip service to the poskim and is passing from the sugya. If you look at Igros Moshe. It's not really true. Ramosha was really intimately familiar with all the poskim, as they call them. And usually there is at least one place, if not two, where he, will, if you read it carefully, you should be able to figure out, or I many times was able to figure out, what I felt Ramosha's approach to what I call the classic approach to a sugya was. But again, that is a sort of historical.
You know, Shefa told over a story, this was about this, he said, like Rav Moshe would like write his answer and give it over to his gabbai or someone, that a guy would like look through like the achronim, like the chassam sofer. It's like Rav Moshe, chassam sofer says otherwise, so he changed to, even though the chassam sofer says otherwise.
Yeah, that's true. He gave it up to Rav Tuvia Goldstein. That's true. He gave it up to Rav Tuvia Goldstein. He was a big bucky in Tshuva Sachronim. He's a big bucky in Tshuva Sachronim. That's right. And for Tshuva Sachronim. No, okay, look, there's a difference between Tshuva Sachronim, which Rav Moshe not necessarily knew every single one of them, and between the basics of the sugya with the Rishonim and Tur Beis Yosef, etc., etc. Shulchan Aruch Nosei Kelo. Shulchan Aruch Nosei Kelo, Rav Moshe definitely knew Kol. Did he know every single Jew of Zacharana? No, the answer on that is no, he did not know every single Jew of Zacharana.
But the point is like it didn't even matter. Like, it was just
That's right. No, you're right. The point of that story, I heard that from other people also. Whatever, I can tell you who I heard it from, but not in the middle of the year. I heard it from the exact same story that he gave Moshe Goldstein wrote him, Tuvi Goldstein wrote him, Chassam Sofer. So it's not the only thing he changed the tshuva was, Delok Chassam Sofer, not like Chassam Sofer, yeah, correct. Okay. Let's see. The Bach in his parish on the tour is somewhat of a machadish, even more than the Beis Yosef. It's like I really personally, as I've said before, I dislike people who like to try to make ironclad rules about we paskin like this, we paskin like that, we paskin like this, we paskin like that. So I don't want to say any ironclad rules. The Bach, of course, he, as we'll see, he has a lot of importance. He gets a lot of mention because he had an important son-in-law. His son-in-law, his name was the Taz.
I like the reference.
What?
Taz is pretty cool.
Yeah, so that, when we get to the Taz, I'll talk more about, I think I mentioned that once already, but we'll talk more about the Taz when we get to, I personally, when I started out learning, I haven't learned halacha in a serious fashion in some time, more or less since I came here, because I'm busy working on things to say to you guys, but when I learned halacha seriously, initially you learn, okay, yeah, you don't have time, don't look at the Bach. I found afterwards, the more you look at the Bach, the better you understand what the Taz wants. Because even when the Taz doesn't explicitly refer to the Bach, he always has the shroud in his mind. He's always there. So it doesn't really true. This is once you did the two. If you did the sugya and the Beis Yosef, it's not that difficult to do the Bach. Okay, weiter. Now for Donnie and for whoever else from the Strauss family who's going to listen to this. Eventually, they're not the only people who I know who are related to the Tosfos Yontif. Tosfos Yontif's name was?
Yom Tov Lipman
Heller. I was not able to find any information. The name, the last name Heller, which is definitely a given name, is again an exception, and it's funny. And I'm not able to determine how they got that name so early. Because most Ashkenazim only adapted the last names well after this. Lived from 1579 to 1654. Classically speaking, he was born in Germany. But he didn't learn in Germany. He learned in Prague. By the Maharal and who else? The Maharal and the Klayaka. He learned in Prague by the Maharal and the Klayaka.
He's my...
That's right. The Klei Yakar is a standard in the Megillas Kedavos, and the Klei Yakar is sort of a Talmud of the Maharal.
Is it mystical?
I wouldn't call them. Okay, when I spoke about the Maharal last year, I don't know if I said it this year, I don't really know that much about Kabbalah. I mean, in the real sense. But most people who run their mouths about it know even less. And there's stuff in the Maharal, there's a significant amount of information in the Maharal which I don't understand. I mean, there's a nice amount that I do understand. Chassidim say that the Maharal has nothing to do with the Kabbalah Sari. And, when we get on to Shabtai Tzvi, I'll tell you some interesting Jewish folklore, which is not even more than folklore, actually, about Shabtai Tzvi and the followers he had, and it would hopefully remember to relate it back to the Maharal. But it doesn't seem to me that the Maharal, even though the Maharal was known as quotes a mystic, etc., doesn't seem that he was. It's almost impossible for him to have Kabbalah Sari. In other words, his dates, which I don't have in front of me right now, but his dates, he died around 1609 or something like that, 1606, 1609. It's not absolutely impossible, but the facts are, I mean, the Ari died in the early 1570s, but the facts are that the Reb Chaim Vital did not really spread Torah's Ari. He held it should only go peh, mouth to mouth. Those who disagreed with him did do it, but it really only came out after most of the Maharal's works had been written. So it's like, I would say it's absolutely impossible, but the Maharal is Shas-based, Shas and Midrasha-based. That's all. He does not mention, if he mentions the Zohar, it's rare. I'm not a big enough bucky to tell you he never mentions the Zohar, but it's rare for the Maharal to mention the Zohar. If he does, that's a rare occurrence. And the Torah's Ari, all the Ari's Torah and Kabbalah, is all based on Zohar. It's all based on Zohar. So, it's, you're really talking about the Tosfos Yontif, and his life, in other words, this life pattern of him being born in Germany but learning in Prague, and he's going to end up moving into Poland, is like kilu, a reflection of what is culturally going on, even though in his life Germany is going to be revitalized significantly. And we'll get to that, I think, next week, not the week after. We'll get, whatever, we're about to get to that. But the rule of, if you want to do serious learning, don't do it in Germany, is already basically started. So he learned, again, he learned in Prague. He was in Rabunas, in Prague, Nikolsburg, Vienna, and then back to Prague for the first part of his life. This gets us up to around, it gets us up to 1629. The common denominator between Prague, Nikolsburg, Vienna is?
They kept
trying to get him from prison. No, they're all part of the Austrian Empire. They're all part of the Austrian Empire. Now, people who write Jewish history books, even those who, I'm actually not sure, you know, which ones are how knowledgeable of not Jewish history or not. Most of them are not that aware that the emperor at this time, the ruler of Austria, it wasn't Austria-Hungary, it was Austria at the time, and they also ruled Hungary. And that we could talk about later over dinner, Shabbos, you know, one of those things, I can explain those things to you. But maybe it's not going to come into this year, into the class this year. His name was Ferdinand II. His name was Ferdinand II. Now, Ferdinand II was a very religious Catholic. We know what the Reformation is, basically?
Yep.
Okay, you know what the Counter-Reformation is?
Yep.
Okay, the Reformation, and we'll maybe talk about that at the end of the lecture, it depends how far we get. We may talk about that today also. The Reformation was the Protestant challenge to the Catholic religion. Counter-Reformation is?
Catholicism.
Trying to reclaim and trying to answer things back. Does anyone know the name of the group, Catholic group, associated most strongly with the Counter-Reformation? No.
Opus Dei.
What?
Who? Opus Dei.
Yep. Okay, no one knows? The Jesuits. We've ever heard of Jesuits?
Yeah.
Okay, the Jesuits were the Jesuits were the order, the monastic order founded, which spearheaded the Catholic Counter-Reformation. Now, the Reformation started in the early 1500s. 1521, I believe 1519 was when Martin Luther nailed up the 100 and whatever theses on the door. And 1521, the early 1520s is when they were cooking. When do you think the Counter-Reformation started?
Not too soon.
No, in the 1570s. It was a long time until the Catholics bothered to get an adrenal reaction. And the reason why it's important for us is, as they say, Ferdinand II had a lot of Catholic teachers. And they said, whatever we planted grew nicely. And he was taught and indoctrinated by the extreme Catholics, by the Jesuits, and was a very, very religious Catholic, which is the meat and guts of the 30 Years' War. We get to 30 Years' War.
Against Russia?
30 Years' War? Complicated. 30 Years' War started out that the Czechs, the Bohemians, attempted to depose Ferdinand II. The Bohemians.
Which phase was first, the Danish?
Okay, 30 Years' War starts out like this. It all started out, he was elected, his brother, his uncle, Habsburg genealogy is so complicated, I can't even remember it. I could probably name every English monarch. I mean, off the top of my head, it's not even hard. From Henry VII, it's not even hard. It's not hard at all. It's a lot of, once you get to the Georges, it's easy. George 1, 2, 3, 4, you got through like 130 years right there. Well, William and Victoria, there you got 200 years. You knocked up 200 years that way. It's not that complicated. But Habsburg genealogy is very complicated, and it wasn't necessarily father to son, but it was very complicated. They were all related to each other like 53 ways, and that was like a slight exaggeration, but not more than that. So it's not that his father died. I don't remember if it was uncle or cousin, or an uncle and a cousin, or whatever it is. He became the head of the Habsburg family in the 1615 or so, and the Bohemians weren't happy about it because most of Germany, most of non-Italy and non-ecclesiastic Germany at this time is Protestant. And they knew that when he had inherited Austria, which is called the homelands of the Habsburgs, he had gotten rid of anyone who refused to conform with him religiously. He had gotten rid of them in a very efficient way, and the Bohemians were scared he was going to do that to them. And they were technically an independent crown, which had elective rights, so they declared him deposed. And there's something very famous called the defenestration.
Defenestration of Prague.
Right, defenestration of Prague, which is?
That he sent two people to make a deal with them and say, okay, listen, I'm going to take over you guys, but you can still rule, but I still rule over all of you.
Right.
And then they
chucked them right out the window. They chucked them right out the window.
They actually threw them out the window.
They literally threw them out the window. Okay, yeah. That's not demonstration, it's defenestration.
And then the Danish face.
We'll get to that. Okay, we'll get to that, but not. We're getting enough off the topic, it's not going to happen until next week, unless we like move quickly now. Okay, but we have to go step by step so you guys understand where Holland came. So that's really. The 30 Years of War is the culmination of religious war in Europe. It's the culmination. And he was a very religious Catholic. So, that is actually very important for the Tosfos Yontif, because we're like slightly out of order. I was really going to do more about this stuff, and we're going to start Yasher Mikandia. But the reason why we're talking about this is he started fighting a very expensive war. And when you fight war, what do you need?
Money.
Money. And if you need money, where do you go?
French.
Jews. Okay, that's more or less how it worked. He wasn't, it's not that he was philo-Semitic. It's not that he was philo-Semitic, that he liked Jews. It is he needed money. And unlike other people, because Jews were so limited in where they could live at this point, they were happy to hand him money for rights. So that was he thought it was a good idea. Now, it's going to get, we'll see in the next week too, that it's going to get much more complicated as things go on. But that's how it started out. Now, what happened was, when they were, had to give donations, pay taxes, etc., the rabbi, as leader of the community, had the very difficult job of
collecting the taxes,
of deciding who's going to pay what. So when the Tosfos Yontif was in Prague, this came in last year, not this year, but I guess I'll repeat it again. Ferdinand II's predecessor's predecessor, approximately, whose name was Rudolf.
The red-nosed reindeer.
No. Whose name was Rudolf, who was also a Holy Roman Emperor. He was actually very friendly with the Maharal. And as a result of his friendship with the Maharal...
Prague?
Yes. As a result of that friendship, he allowed Jews more or less to live in Prague and other places in Bohemia, unlimited. And not only had to let them live there, but he did not allow the guilds to bar them from more or less whatever they wanted to do. So Prague grew into the largest Jewish community outside of Poland pretty quickly. Not only large, this is also very well to do. So now we have a different monarch, Ferdinand II. Ferdinand II is fighting a very expensive war. And he needs a lot of money, so he goes to the Jews. Okay, so the Tosfos Yontif had the difficult job of trying to figure out who should pay taxes. And of course, as you know, there's no way, no one likes paying taxes. That's just the facts of life. As I told a friend of mine who wrote an article about Dina de Malchusadina and about not cheating on taxes, I told him, look, no one wants to hear that. He tried to get it printed, no one would print it. I said, no one wants to hear that. No one likes to pay taxes. Okay? That's the blunt facts. So, of course, we were talking about big money, and he was accused of favoritism, managed to get out of that. However, his enemies were still mad at him, so they did something much worse. They accused him of blasphemy, blaspheming Catholicism. And if you accuse someone of blaspheming Catholicism to Ferdinand II, there's no stopping him. Initially, they convicted the Tosfos Yontif of blasphemy. The Sefer he wrote, strangely, was on. It's called what? No, that's later. That's much later. The Sefer he wrote that was accused of blasphemy, strangely, is something called, was originally called Matane Melech. It's on Brachas, Chun, Nida, Mikvos, Hilchos Ketanos. How they managed to construe, these are very, basic daily halacha, it's only missing Shabbos and Pesachim to have like the meat of all Orach Chaim and Yerodeya in it. But it's the meat of Yerodeya and a significant amount of Orach Chaim. Chelek Aleph, Chelek Aleph, Beis Mishnah Berurah, that's Brachas more or less. And between Chulin and Nida, that's the meat of Yerodeya. I'll talk about the Chibur later. But I don't get how they could accuse him of blasphemy. They went blasphemous statements they supposedly found in these Kiburim, in these works, because it's not like, if he wrote something like the Rambam's Hilchos Teshuva, so the Rambam says if you believe in an intermediary, and Catholics definitely believe in intermediaries in more than one way, then you would accuse him of blasphemy. Okay, you know what? There's a Kilu. I mean, he's not saying what non-Jews should do, he's saying what Jews should do. I would sort of hear it in a certain sense. But accusing the Tosfos Yontif of a blasphemy in this case, like, doesn't make much sense. But, okay, whatever it was, they convicted him. Initially, he was convicted to death. And then they managed to change him. They managed to convince him to edit out the blasphemous parts. And no longer hold rabbinic post in Austrian domination. So that's what happened. And as a result of that, he went on to Poland. Spent the rest of his life in Poland. A number of different places, and ended up in Krakow. Okay, we definitely know what the Tosfos Yontif best known for. The Tosfos Yontif, right? Do you know when he wrote the Tosfos Yontif?
Tosfos Yontif.
How old was he when he wrote Tosfos Yontif?
18.
You are right. Nose on the head. You knew that?
I mean,
you made it a fist. 18. He was 18 years old when he wrote the Batur Kama. The original edition of Tosfos Yontif, he wrote when he was 18.
So basically, if I write something that you use this year, I'll beat him.
Well, almost 19.
I'm planning on it.
What's the Tosfos Yontif doing? It's completing the Mishnah picture. That's what it's doing. The Rambam, let's go back now to the evolution of Perush and Mishnah. The first person to write on the Mishnah is the Rambam. The Rambam writes running commentary. In other words, you have the Mishnah, and the Rambam comments on the entirety of the Mishnah, or two or three Mishnahs, in one blah. Okay? That's what the Rambam. The Bartanura, the Ra, the Bartanura. Okay. Here we go. He came, and he broke it up similar to Rashi. Tibur Hamaskels. He made it more user-friendly, similar to Rashi.
One was Kahati.
Well, you want to get to Kahati, I'll talk about Kahati.
No, I want to talk about that guy.
Well, just wait a second. Now, there's two key problems with the Bartanura. There's two problems with the Bartanura that Tosfos Yontif had problems with. One is, he sticks to basically Rashi and or the Rabbi. That's one problem.
The problem is,
it has the Bartanura there. The other thing was, he felt there were issues that were important to talk about even when you're just learning Mishnah. that Bartanur didn't get around to talking about. So he does that. So the name of this, the name of the work is Tosis Yontif, and similar to Tosis and Shas, the Tosis and Shas is not for everybody. You know, Rashi is for everybody, even though Rashi is very deep and has something to say about everything. But Rashi works on all levels. The Tosis Yontif is a similar concept, that even though the part of the Tosis Yontif, which is, let's say, at least 30%, if not a little more, which is commentary oriented, which is for anybody. And there's a lot of places where, like, there's obvious questions. I just, the other day, I'm going over about Basra right now. And the Mishnah states, for example, about Basra, that Seder Hanachlis, it's a Mishnah, Seder Hanachlis is you go son, daughter, father, brother, and then afterwards other relatives. But the Mishnah says you go son and any descendants of the son. And the descendants of the son are before the daughter. Daughter and all of her descendants. And they're before the father. That's how it works. Okay. So the question is, the Bartender doesn't bother telling me where I learned that from. The Tosis Yontif does. That's classic. Of course, there are times where the Tosenta feels that Bartanura oversimplified, which is wrong, and it's similar to what Tosenta does to Rashi, the Tosenta does to the Bartanura. That's a Tosenta. That's like Kilo, his main claim to fame. Okay. He also wrote, as mentioned, Madani Melech on, again, the meat of Orachem and Yerodeh.
He's an Achron.
He's an Achron, yes. He's an early Achron, but he's an Achron. He wrote Madani Melech on the meat of Or HaChaim and Yerodea. However, this gets back to our issue, and we spoke about it tonight already once, so speak about it again. What did he write Madani Melech on? What is it based on? Madani Melech is now called Madani Yontif. What's it written on? It's written on the Rush. Okay? He wrote it as, he has two parts to it. One is called Madani Melech, one is called Lechem Chamudos. It could be they changed that name, I don't remember. And one of them is sort of like explanation of the Rush, including also a compendium of the main Shittas Achrona, Mishittas Rishono and Achrona, who argue with the Rush, or how you understand the Rush and the tour, and the other one is more based on his own Kedushin. Now that, it sort of leads one to believe, even though I'm not really 100% sure about this, that, you know, because he's writing on the Rush, a Rush-based Perish, that means he's assuming you're going to spend significant time looking at the Rush. So in terms of that question of what is the primary focus? Should you primarily focus on Tur, Beis Yosef, Shulchan Aruch, and Shulchan Aruch? Or you should primarily focus on Sugyas? Well, Chara, we see that the Tosfos Yontif assumed, or was of the opinion that you should focus more on the Sugya than on the Tur, Beis Yosef, etc. Because again, where did he write his Perush? He wrote his Perush on the Rush. Okay.
How did these people decide what they wanted to write their Perush on?
Yosef, you're asking a good question.
Did they just look at one day of the Rush? Man, I really feel like writing on the Rush. You know what I mean?
But how's the Rush different than the Riff this turn of the day?
How's the Rush different than the Riff? Okay, the Rush is different than the Riff that the Rush synthesizes the Darche Psak of the Riff and the Rambam and the Sephardi Poskim with the Re and Tosasin. Because the Rush himself started out his life in Germany, and ended off his life in Spain. And I spoke about him last year. So that is what the Rush does. The Rush is very keen, important. You know, key, if the Rush wouldn't have done it, I'm not sure you needed a reason to do that. As I spoke about last year. You couldn't, if not, we'd be sort of in the dark what you do about a lot of places. There's some places where there's clear conflict, which is not key, as difficult, because there's Kali Psak. There's ways to understand how to do things with these things. But there's more than that. There's a lot of times when it's not clear that they're really arguing. And it's good that we have Rishonim who already addressed the issues, because if not, we wouldn't be that clear about it.
But other than that, the Rush writes in the same format as the
Riff. Right? The Rush is closest in style to the Riff, correct? The Russian style is closest to the Riff. A lot of times when you think the Rush is quoting the Gemara, he's really quoting the Riff.
Huh.
Yeah. It took a long time. It took a long time for me to figure that one out, but yeah, I'm pretty confident that one's true. Okay. He also wrote on the entirety of Nezikin, a Perush on the Rush called
Pilpula Charifta. Oh, the spicy pepper.
The spicy pepper. See this over here? Pilpula Charifta. On the bottom of the rush, it means sharp discussion.
That's
the
Tosfos
Yatav.
It means sharp discussion, actually.
I know that Gemara, because Joshua gave me the reference for it. It's Pilpula Charifta more than a pumpkin or something, right?
Okay, fine. That's what the Tosfos Yatav wrote, and again, it's fascinating. He's best known as Tosfos Yatav, but he did write a lot of other things. Not all printed. Okay, now getting on to the famous legend. I don't know who I promised the two famous Jewish legends today. Okay. Have you ever heard the famous story of Yossel the Miser? Yossel the Holy Miser. Do I have to say the story over?
I've heard the famous story.
Okay, I need a guitar. Okay. Yeah, Yossel the Holy Miser. Okay, everyone in Krakow, they needed something. This is rich guy Yossel.
Oh, yeah,
right. They go to him and say they needed. He sounded like he was on the venue and say, "Sorry, I don't have anything. I can't help you out." Fine. He eventually dies.
He's very rich.
That's right. Eventually he dies. And no one wants to go to his funeral. And they bury him because he was so stingy. Instead of burying him in the regular part of the Mesa Kfars, they bury him in the corner.
They bury him near where all the poor people are buried.
That's where they bury him. And then that Erev Shabbos, there is a major uproar. Everyone starts coming to the rabbi of the city, saying, "Look, you know, we used to get every Erev Shabbos. We used to get
money.
Or whatever we needed, a package, an anonymous package came to us every single night. And one, over and over and over and over. So the rabbi figures out, it's not a coincidence. Figures out it must have been Yossel the Holy Miser. He says, what a mistake we made. And he said, okay, to rectify the mistake, when he dies, he should be buried next to Yossel the Holy Miser. Now, there's two things. The rabbi of the story was the Tosfos Yatav. And the facts are, the fact is two facts. It's not, there's two facts. Fact one is the Tosfos Yatav is buried in the corner of the Beis HaKfaris next to a kever, which is identified as the kever of Yossel the Holy Miser. So that sort of substantiates, doesn't prove it absolutely. The story is recorded around 200 years ago already. Something called Pikus Krakow. Krakow community's notes as recorded 200 years ago. The only thing is the name of the Holy Miser wasn't Yossel. Should have been late. But besides that, it's one of these stories which I personally think is probably true, even though you can't absolutely substantiate it. Again, there's two very strong, you know, a 200-year-old legend and a story which totally is only 350 years old. It doesn't absolutely prove it, but...
Is that old of a story?
The Tosfos Yatav died in 1654. So if the story of Yossel the Holy Miser happened, it must have happened not long before that, so a little over 350 years ago, and the Tosfos Yatav himself... Tosfos Yatav himself is buried in Kiel. He's buried in the wrong part of the basic forest. He's buried in the corner. What is he buried in the corner for? He should be buried next to the Mount Megala Mukas. He was one of the... They knew he was one of the great rabbanim of Krakow. They knew that. Is he buried in the wrong place for? So that does substantiate the story. Okay, now we're about to start Yashar Mikandia.
No more story.
Yeah, that's no more story. That's right. That's the end of that story. Now, we're going to a very important point. We're going to tip the surface here. Because I've got a lot more here, but we're just going to hit the first part of it. We are at the borderline of modern times now. The borderline of all the modern problems which we think have only existed for the last 150 to 100, 150 years, 200, 150, 200 years, it's not really true. I hold they existed for 400 years already. Okay. Now, we go back again. We're going to go back quickly. We're going to breeze through Portuguese Jewish history, which is very important. That's the crux of all of these problems, were the Portuguese New Christians / the Portuguese Muranos Crypto-Jews. They are at the meat of all these problems. 1497, they were forced to convert. Until the Spanish absorbed Portugal in around 1580, the Portuguese weren't that serious about enforcing Inquisition, not allowing them to do privately what they wanted to do. So, pre-1580, most of them stayed in Portugal. It's impossible to know. In the earlier eras, one feels that they still didn't know Hebrew, but we can almost prove without a doubt that by 1580, the period we're getting to now, they probably did not know Hebrew. Some of them knew how to read Hebrew. It's not even clear how many knew how to read Hebrew. Okay, that we could, we'll be able to show that. I don't know if we'll get to this week, but I'll be able to show you that almost without a doubt. Okay, now, as they say, you know, they say this about you know, Columbus in America. That's completely inaccurate. Now people say Columbus. That is true. This fact is true. Columbus went out on his voyage of discovery, which eventually he discovered what became America. The same day the Jews were expelled from Spain. I mean, that's true, but the Jews didn't find America as a haven and a refuge for a couple hundred years after, a couple of years after that. But this is true. And around the same time when the Jews, when the crypto Jews, when the Muranos of Portugal, who were, as mentioned earlier, were really committed Jews, when they started having real problems in Portugal, that is the exact same time when the Great Dutch Rebellion started. Now, the Habsburgs, who are ruling over half of Europe, they really started out, and we think we talk about the Spanish Habsburgs and the Austrian Habsburgs, but that's not where they started out. They started out in Belgium. That's where they started out. So, again, the Belgians and Dutch, more than the Belgians, became Protestant. And Spanish were Catholic, and they were, even before the Jesuits and the Counter-Reformation, serious Catholics. There's another issue that, in terms of finances, after the Habsburgs took Spain, they moved their home to Spain, they used the lowlands, they called them, as a source of money. And they were always a, you know, in terms of finances and you know, and where goods went, that was the entrepot. That's how you got stuff to Germany. Germany really didn't have much of, you know, didn't have much of a merchant marine. You trade through Germany from anywhere, from France, Spain, Mediterranean, all went through the low countries. So they weren't happy. They had two problems with the Spanish. One problem was a religious problem. Another problem was a financial problem. So in 1568, they started a rebellion. It was a very long rebellion. The rebellion legally took 80 years. In other words, the Dutch started the rebellion in 1568 and were not declared legally independent until 1648. Now, practically speaking, it didn't take nearly that long. By around 1585, they had gained technical independence. There's a lot, you know, in a Jewish history class, we can go through all the ups and downs and backs and forths and how this happened. But in around 1585, they had gained legal independence. So, even though they only had basically de facto legal independence in 1585, but as you can figure out yourself, there was a lot of fighting and anarchy going on from 1568. Now, the other side of the coin is like this. They were legally part of the Spanish Empire. Because Portugal is also legally part of the Spanish Empire. So I can move from one place, that's like moving from one state to another. And the Muranos understood that in a place with a lot of anarchy, they're not going to be looked at. People aren't going to look. There's a lot of Inquisition problems in Portugal. and a decent amount in Spain. But in the low countries, in Belgium and Holland, there's not such a problems. That was stage one. So a lot of them started moving there. Stage, and it was also good financial. These people now had an excellent, they also had excellent economic opportunity because they had all, you know, some of them stayed in Spain and Portugal. Some of them moved to Antwerp, and they initially moved to Antwerp, which is a great port city. Maybe next week I'll bring in a map to show you why exactly. But they, maybe I'll do that. But they moved to Antwerp, and they had great financial, they had great trade connections. Because they had connections to Spain. From Spain, they had connections to the Mediterranean and also to America. And from America to China. They were like wheeling and dealing everything all over the place, which, you know, Jews like doing that. Okay? Now what happened was, at around the same time, again, the Dutch rebel. And I don't know, and this is a little earlier than Philo-Semitism starts. So I think this is more of a case of my enemy's enemies are my friends. And because the Dutch enemy was the Spanish, and the Spanish hated the Jews, so the Dutch figured, okay, the Spanish hate the Jews, and we should get on with the Jews. They also knew they could make money out of it. So between the two, they started a pro-Jewish policy. Let's just finish this piece off and we'll finish. They started a pro-Jewish policy. And what they did in terms of actuality is they also blockaded Antwerp. And that we need a map. I can show you on a map exactly how they did it. They blockaded Antwerp. And even though initially the Jews went to Antwerp, they all started the crypto, the Muranos crypto Jews started moving to Antwerp. They all moved from there to Amsterdam. And starting in 1595, that is the beginning of the great Svarti, the great wealthy, important, influential Svarti community. Amsterdam, Hamburg, Altona. That's a net of connections, of trade connections from Amsterdam spreading through northern Germany. It's going to branch into London also. So that's very important. This is like the beginning. Now we're going to get why it's important for Yashar from Kandia. We're going to get to next. We'll get Yashar from Kandia was originally from Crete. And how he got from Crete, from Greece, from Crete, all the way to there. We'll talk about that next week. Fine.